I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, and this is the Regional Roundup. Ahead this hour, the battle over a proposed liquefied natural gas terminal along the Delaware River in Gibbstown, New Jersey. Also, we'll visit with Papo Vasquez, the trombonist, composer, arranger, and North Philly native, is releasing his latest album of Latin jazz. But to begin, as events continue to unfold following last week's riot at the Capitol, we're going to take a look at the deepening ideological divide among elected representatives in Pennsylvania on the federal and state levels. Even as House and Senate leaders of both parties on Capitol Hill were decrying Wednesday's violence, 8 Republican members of the U.S. House from Pennsylvania voted to overturn the presidential election results at the urging of GOP leaders in Harrisburg. So what happens next? Will the end of the Trump administration and the beginning of the Biden era in Washington eventually dampen the acrimony evident among many of Pennsylvania's elected officials, or will both sides remain firmly in their respective camps? Joining us now with analysis is WHYY's political reporter, Katie Meyer. Katie, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
So in a week and a half, President-elect Joe Biden will be inaugurated, and as you report, fractures in Pennsylvania's evenly split congressional delegation have widened, and lawmakers in Pennsylvania are trying to figure out where to go from here. Katie, let's get more of a sense of what the thinking is behind this split. Guessing alleged election fraud is at the heart of this?
Yeah, no question. I mean, I think we saw a pretty profound difference in, let's say, interpretation of the facts. Last week, you know, after this violent insurrection we saw at the Capitol, 8 of Pennsylvania's 9 GOP congressmen voted to overturn Pennsylvania's election results. And they all had sort of various claims of inconsistencies in the voting process. But the, you know, point of fact is nobody has alleged any sort of widespread voter fraud or indeed any voter fraud or impropriety that would overturn this election or could affect enough votes to change the results. So, a lot of them are kind of justifying a vote like this and saying that, well, lots of people are very concerned about election fraud. Therefore, we need to make their concerns heard in Congress. But again, not providing evidence to back up those concerns. So yeah. I think, you know, Democrats are looking at this now and some Republicans and saying, you know, we need to take a stronger stand about this. We need to, you know, let the results of the election lie and, you know, move forward. But, you know, now saying it is going to be difficult with this sort of profound split.
Was there any sense of a reckoning or rethinking about claims of election impropriety among members of Pennsylvania's Republican congressional delegation immediately after the attack last week? Was there any chatter about that?
I mean, there was. I mean, listen, I talked to as many congressional members last week as I could. I wasn't able to get a lot of the Republicans on the record, so I don't know exactly what they were thinking. But all of them in the comments that they made on the floor, again, after this attack, you know, they acknowledged that it was bad. They said they do not support any violence. You know, one Republican guy, Rushenthaler from Western Pennsylvania, he didn't speak on the floor, which I thought was kind of interesting because generally he would speak on stuff like this. So, you know, I mean, it's really hard to say. I do think there's a sense from these Republicans that they're like, okay, now let's move forward. But you've also seen from others, specifically Senator Pat Toomey, the Republican senator from Pennsylvania who did not vote in favor of this, basically saying, like, this is a problem. We need to condemn this in stronger terms. He called Trump. Well, first he said that he had supported Trump the entire, you know, stretch of his presidency, but then he did call him a demagogue and said that the election fraud claims were baseless. So you see some grappling there, but I should note Toomey's not running for re-election.
Yeah. GOP State Senator Doug Mastriano was in the crowd of Trump supporters at the Capitol on Wednesday. He says he was not involved with the actual riot. But still, Katie, is there any sign there will be some sort of censure, at the very least, for Mastriano on the state level?
Well, Democrats certainly want that to happen. They've called for Mastriano's resignation, you know, loudly and often. Republicans don't seem compelled to, you know, make any penalty happen there. Jake Corman, the Senate President pro tem, he said that Mastriano has assured him that he was not storming the Capitol. Mastriano says he left when he saw things getting violent. So, yeah, he says there's a right to peacefully assemble, and that's what Mastriano did, and he's not gonna censure him. There's not going to be any penalties there.
Yeah, and interesting, I've heard that Mastriano is expected to launch a run for governor in 2022. And, of course, this is purely speculation, Katie, but we'll see how all this might affect that run.
Yeah, he's certainly in the mix.
Yeah. You also interviewed former Republican Congressman Charlie Dent, who is a moderate. Mm-hmm. What is his take on all this?
Well, Dent, again, he has always been the kind of person who I think, you know, his impulse is toward collegiality, is toward consensus, right? And so I talked to him, and I actually talked to Susan Wild, the Democrat who has Dent's former seat. Both of them, you know, the seat that Dent held and Wild holds. Lehigh Valley is sort of a purple seat, pretty flippable. And, I mean, both of them basically said, and I'll just, you know, quote it from Dent here. Mm-hmm. Let me find it. I don't know if I can find it. But anyway, he said basically that, you know, there needs to be a reckoning about this. And the Republicans need to, you know, let this stuff go, essentially. He had some pretty strong words for the Republicans who voted this way.
My understanding is he believes the reason many or most of the elected officials voted against their own state's slate of electors is they feel political retribution from Trump's base. Is that your understanding?
I've reported on this. I've heard from members that this is the case, that they've been inundated with these messages saying, you know, you have to do something about election fraud. You have to. And so I think there's no question, and we should be very clear about this, that, you know, the rhetoric from Trump that the election was stolen, people, you know, heard that and they believed it and took it really to heart and wanted to see some action from their elected representatives who often really, really depend on them for votes. So, yeah, there's no question that public pressure from, you know, the kind of Republicans or Trump supporters, I guess, who we saw storming the Capitol, and even, you know, support from people who maybe didn't want to take that step but really believed that there was impropriety, you know, that has had a direct result in how we have seen our legislators respond to this stuff. There's no question.
Sure. There have been calls, of course, for Vice President Mike Pence to invoke the 25th Amendment to begin the process of removing the president from office, or alternatively, it looks as if Congress, the House of Representatives will move to impeach President Trump. Where does Pennsylvania's congressional delegation stand here, Katie Meyer?
In terms of impeachment, yeah, invoking the 25th Amendment, there's a range of responses. I think we've seen, for instance, from Senator Toomey, who is one of the Republican voices from Pennsylvania who's in favor of some penalties here. He has said he's not sure if impeachment's the best path forward. He doesn't know if, you know, there's time. But he also thinks that Trump should resign. So that's, you know, Toomey's not a moderate guy, I should say. And again, he's not running for reelection. But that's one of the stronger statements we have seen from a conservative Republican on this. Then for Democrats, a lot of them have signed on to impeachment. I mentioned that I had talked to Susan Wild, one of the more moderate Democrats. She, even in the middle of last week, was on the fence about how impeachment would work, but she is on board now.
Okay.
I haven't seen Brian Fitzpatrick is the one Republican who didn't vote in favor of overturning Pennsylvania's election results, and I haven't seen where he's going to come down on this. I'm trying to follow up with him. But, I think for the most part, you see, as we expect right now, a partisan split. So most of Pennsylvania's Democrats are on board with basically doing whatever they can to get Trump out of office. And you see the Republicans sort of saying, like, okay, well, you know, we can move past this and it's going to be fine.
Remind us, Katie, of the facts around one of the central contentions of impropriety in Pennsylvania's election, alleged, of course, impropriety. You know, Republican U.S. Senator Josh Hawley of Missouri attacked Pennsylvania's no-excuse mail voting law. But the fact is, Republicans in Harrisburg were solidly behind the enactment of this statute a couple of years ago.
Yeah, that's kind of a funky one. That allegation came up relatively late in the game. The lawsuits we saw earlier in the process of Republicans contesting the election, you generally had to do with, like, sort of specific tranches of ballots in specific counties that they thought weren't kosher, basically. But that one stems from this lawsuit that Congressman Mike Kelly out in the western part of the state filed. And his allegation was that the state legislature had passed this no excuse mail voting expansion, which they passed in 2019. He thought they'd passed it unconstitutionally. Basically, what he said is it should have been a constitutional amendment. They passed it as a simple bill. It should be thrown out. And at the time, there was, you know, debate over whether it should be a bill or should be an amendment, and they decided that a bill was the best move. This is all getting into the weeds. But I say this because, you know, it was a Republican legislature, the Republican Party, who championed this bill and pushed it to get passed. They passed it almost unanimously. People who voted against it were mostly Democrats because it got rid of straight party voting, which they didn't want. But that thing passed. It was bipartisan. It was a big expansion, but there was really no question about whether it was the right thing to do. And so this lawsuit that Kelly signed on to, and there was another state house candidate out in Western PA that also was part of this, they filed it, and the court said, you filed this way too late. You can't, you know, contest the rules after the election happened. And so it was thrown out. And so they really, I mean, they didn't rule on the merits of it because the merits, you know, didn't hold up to the standards of the court. And so Hawley is claiming now that the courts have never ruled on this, like, you know, this is something that we need to talk about. And that's just not true. The courts have ruled. They have said you cannot change the rules of the election after the election happens, even if you don't like the results. And, you know, I think it's kind of hard to argue with that. Well, so, yeah, that's kind of where that stands.
Looking ahead, though, Katie, Republicans in Harrisburg are now considering rolling this back, and I think it's Act 77 we're talking about, right? The name of it?
Yeah. And I've reported on this a little bit. They've, again, feeling a lot of pressure from constituents to do something, and so we're looking, some of them are looking at Act 77 rollbacks. I don't think there's like a critical mass of support for getting rid of the whole no excuse mail voting, but for instance, they want to tighten up the law to not allow ballot drop boxes, and they want to make it clearer that, like, if you forget your to date your ballot, they can't count those, and that people can't fix their ballots if the counties notice that there's a problem with them. Like, things like that happened in this election that Republicans were not happy with because they felt it wasn't in the original law. And again, that stuff, the Department of State made these rulings. They've been, you know, widely upheld by the state Supreme Court. So I don't know if there's a big question about that anymore now for this election, but going forward, Republicans have been moving to tighten.
Yes, stay tuned. So one more quick question for you, Katie. Democrats remain a minority in both houses in Harrisburg. There was a blow up last Tuesday over the GOP's refusal to allow a reelected Democrat, Jim Brewster, to assume his seat in the state Senate. Any indication as to how long it might be before the disagreement over Brewster's win is resolved?
Yeah, that's going to be a question of what the federal court does. So I don't know how much time
we've got. About 15 seconds.
Okay. Well, let's just say we're going to hopefully get a federal court ruling this week, and we will see what they say. That's going to determine the path going forward. So stay tuned. Maybe I'll come back later in the week to let you know more about that.
All right. Thanks, Katie.
All right. Take care.
Katie Meyer reports on politics for WHYY News. Just ahead, we're going to talk about a proposed liquefied natural gas terminal for South Jersey along the Delaware River. The Delaware Riverkeeper's Tracy Carluccio will be along. Stay tuned. Welcome back to the Regional Roundup. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. For decades, beginning in the late 19th century, DuPont's factory complex in Gibbstown, New Jersey, produced dynamite, employing thousands of local residents before it closed about 20 years ago. The plant left a legacy of hazardous waste, and even as ongoing cleanup continues, there are new plans for several hundred acres of the old site. A company named New Fortress Energy wants to build a liquefied natural gas terminal. The terminal would serve as a transfer point for liquefied natural gas as it's moved from trucks or trains to ocean-going ships. The project has apparently won the go-ahead from entities including the Delaware River Basin Commission, of which New Jersey is a part, and labor unions who say building a new LNG terminal at Gibbstown will create hundreds of jobs. Where Governor Murphy himself lands on this is perhaps less clear, and opponents say the whole thing is a bad idea, citing potential safety and environmental hazards. The Delaware Riverkeeper Network is among those groups opposing the project, and we are joined now by the network's Deputy Director, Tracy Carluccio. Good to have you here, Tracy.
Thank you, Mary. Good to be here. Thank you for having us on.
Of course. And we did reach out to the State Department of Environmental Protection in New Jersey, but they are not participating today because of current legal involvement in the issue. So, and also, just want to make this note, lines are open if you'd like to join the conversation as a listener, 888-477-9499. Send us an email at radiotimes@whyy.org. Or tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. So, Tracy, let's begin by outlining what you believe is wrong with this project. Characterize the potential for environmental damage.
Right. Thank you. So I think first, Mary, it's important to appreciate the breadth of the proposed Gibbstown LNG export terminal. The terminal site is on the Delaware River. It's about 15 minutes south of Philadelphia, less than 2 miles from the Philadelphia airport, and about 2.5 miles north of Chester, Pennsylvania, the closest dense urban area. And it also adjoins the backyards of the residents of Gibbstown. But the far-flung components of the supply chain reach up into north-central Pennsylvania to the Marcellus Shale gas wells that would be fracked for the gas to make the LNG at a plant in Wyalusing Township in Bradford County up there. And once it is super-cooled down to minus 260 degrees Fahrenheit and condensed down 600 times, it would then be loaded into trucks or, as you mentioned, rail cars, about 300 to 400 trucks a day, up to 200 100-car trains per day, every day of the year. And the trains would cut through Pennsylvania communities, going right through Philadelphia neighborhoods, for instance, across the Delaware River and south to Gibbstown, exposing more than 1 million people along the way to a 2-mile high hazard zone where the worst of the effects would be felt should there be a derailment or an accident, but also people from outside of that area as well. And it could result actually in a catastrophic fire, an explosion, worse than the Lac Mégantic crude oil train disaster, which many people know about. But that's why they call them bomb trains, and that's why they call them bomb trucks. But the project's danger would intensify once it gets to the Delaware River. And that's because the dock they want to build at Gibbstown, it's an expansion of an existing terminal there, would triple the activity at that site by adding 2 shipping berths. And they propose to transload this flammable and potentially explosive liquid methane from the trucks and the rail cars day and night, 365 days a year, directly onto the waiting ships. It's an extremely risky operation that's never been done at this scale any place in the United States, and for good reason, because the industry themselves consider the transloading process to be the most dangerous part of the LNG handling.
Okay.
And they minimize it to about 1 day to fill a ship. From storage sites at Gibbstown, it will take 2 weeks and it will never, ever stop.
Okay.
So that exposes the entire region to safety hazards, and also local communities really are being used as guinea pigs here.
Well,
it also has environmental impacts.
Let's just get into that in a second, Tracy. I do want to.
Played by the agency.
I do want to roll back just a second, and I just want to clarify. You said liquid methane. Is it natural? Are we talking about the same thing, natural gas and methane?
Liquefied natural gas is natural gas that has been cooled down to this super cold temperature and reduced 600 times into a liquid form.
Okay. All right. So you're, you know, what you're describing is potentially extraordinarily hazardous. There is a social justice component to the argument against this terminal. You mentioned Philadelphia. You mentioned trains going through Philadelphia. You also mentioned Chester, which I think you said is just a couple miles away from this proposed terminal. Again, what would the potential danger be to the city of Chester?
Well, Chester, as you may know, is an environmental justice community. It actually began, you could say, the environmental justice movement a couple decades ago by identifying themselves as an overburdened community of people of color and low-income folks who are being exposed to disproportionately environmental dangers. And as a result, there are higher levels of negative health effects, and the people in Chester are fighting still to this day for dangerous facilities such as an incinerator there and other insults to try to protect the community. And here, another facility is coming in that poses great safety hazards and also environmental dangers associated with water quality impacts. And it's coming in just, you know, at their doorstep and also very close to the New Jersey communities who also are environmental justice communities. Many people of color and low-income communities line all the train tracks and the truck routes, and they also are in the environs of this Gibbstown terminal. So once again, we are making an area into a sacrifice zone if we allow this project to be built.
So,
and
Tracy,
it's absolutely unacceptable.
So Governor Murphy has said, again, the Delaware River Basin Commission apparently has voted to move forward with dock construction at the site. Governor Murphy, a few weeks ago, kind of seems to be straddling both sides of this issue here. He essentially said, okay, dredge, build the dock, but my administration will work to block the transport of LNG at this site. What do you make of this from the state?
Well, it's definitely a two-faced position on the part of the governor. And it is through the Delaware River Basin Commission that Governor Murphy could have voted down this project. As a matter of fact, when they had the meeting on December 9th, a motion was offered by New York to basically not approve the project until further analysis was done into the water quality and environmental issues posed by the tremendous amount of dredging there and the dangerous pollutants that would be stirred up and the damage to the Atlantic and short-nosed sturgeon, which are federally endangered species, but also because of climate impacts and the fact that New York has a very strong climate law now, and New Jersey, Governor Murphy, needs to walk the talk about what he cares about. He says he wants to decarbonize, and we want to see those words put into action. If he's saying that he really does not want LNG to be exported from there, he could have voted it down. However, he has many opportunities through his jurisdiction in the state of New Jersey to stop the project now through pending permits. Delaware Riverkeeper Network is appealing the approval that was given by New Jersey for the major state permit there. We believe they have permits they have not received that they must get.
Okay.
And then there are also many other opportunities to stop the project if Governor Murphy really is going to walk that talk.
All right, so I'd like to get into that in just a moment, what's going on on the court level. But let's get back to where natural gas sits in the effort to move toward clean energy. Proponents say it leaves a smaller impact on the environment than, you know, coal or even nuclear energy. It's a way to move us away from dirtier fuels as we move toward clean energy. Can we get from point A to point B without natural gas? Tracy Carluccio.
Absolutely, we can get to point A and point B. As a matter of fact, if we go through natural gas like we're doing right now, we're actually increasing the climate crisis. And if we look at this Gibbstown project cradle to grave, the full life cycle of greenhouse gas emissions from LNG, liquid methane is the same or worse than coal in terms of atmospheric warming. And that exacerbates climate change. That's because methane is 86 times more powerful than carbon in heating the atmosphere on a 20-year time frame. And that is the time frame that we need to be reducing our greenhouse gas emissions. All the scientists are saying we're supposed to be achieving a 45 to 50% reduction in greenhouse gas emissions by 2030 to contain the worst impacts of climate change. And here we are in that very same time frame, increasing our greenhouse gas emissions by inducing fracking and continuing the expansion of fossil fuel development. It's wrong, and it is simply, you know, there's really no place in our modern society to continue to go run after and throw lifesavers like this project to the dying fracking industry.
So let's get back to dredging for a moment, because the administration said it is in support of dredging that site. And you mentioned toxins that could be released during the dredging. PCBs are a concern, as I understand. What is the negative effect on humans and wildlife? What's the potential effect if these things are stirred up during the dredging process?
Right. You're exactly right, Mary. These pollutants that are legacy pollutants from the use of the site by DuPont for over 100 years will be released through the not only the construction of the site, but the operation of the site. And PCBs are one of them. And they're much more highly toxic than we even thought 15 years ago. They're connected to human health effects, and they're also deadly to wildlife. We know that the federally endangered Atlantic sturgeon, for instance, is very sensitive to PCBs. And this is an area in Gibbstown there, along Gloucester County riverfront, that is actually has grown back as a natural location for many fish and wildlife. And as a result of that, this little green spot in the middle of an industrial area has become the place where the young of the year for the Atlantic sturgeon live. And it's also very important in terms of water quality impacts for those who receive their water upstream in Philadelphia, for instance. The river is tidal, so toxics move upstream as well as downstream with the tide. And so we even are threatening the Philadelphia water intakes, the New Jersey American water intakes for all of South Jersey by releasing these highly toxic pollutants, PCBs, nitrobenzene, aniline. We know that they are there. It's verified through the EPA, and some of it has been cleaned up, but the groundwater has not, and that's what we're concerned about.
Tracy Carluccio is with the Delaware Riverkeeper Network. Tracy, have you yourself personally reached out to people within the Murphy administration? And if so, and this is aside from any, you know, court legal filings, et cetera, and if so, have you heard anything from them? What are they telling you?
Yes. Well, we have a coalition of organizations. We actually have many layers of coalitions in all four Delaware River watershed states, including Philadelphia, where residents are working very hard to fight the trains to go through their neighborhoods. But also in New Jersey, we have an organization called Empower New Jersey, and it's a coalition of over 100 organizations. And the steering committee group, which Oh, I'm sorry.
So now the steering committee group has been reaching out. So have they succeeded in actually just having a casual conversation with people within the Department of Environmental Protection to just try to?
Yes.
Okay. So what is the result of that conversation?
Well, we're waiting to see what they're going to do. Now the point is action. The results should be that the Murphy administration would take the many opportunities that we have presented to the administration that offer them the opportunity to actually stop LNG export from Gibbstown. And we'll see what comes out of that. We have asked for a meeting, but in the past when we have met, it has been basically with the administration's representatives and Department of Environmental Protection and the governor's office. And, they have stood behind the permits that they have given.
Okay.
And we believe that they have made grave errors in applying the law. That's why we're appealing the New Jersey permit. That's why we're appealing the Army Corps of Engineers permit as well. But we believe that there has been no agency, and we are also appealing the Delaware River Basin Commission approval. No agency has done any environmental impact statement on this project. And it's outrageous that a project of this magnitude would not go through the environmental impact statement process.
Let me
so
just jump in
for that,
because we're running up against the clock. I do want to just kind of ask a question from the other side here. This project is supported by labor unions. They say it would create hundreds of construction jobs, some permanent jobs at the facility, along with tax revenue to the community. You know, we're in for some tough economic times here as we move through and away from the pandemic. Is there an argument to be made for taking the risk to put people to work, for taking some risk to put people at
work? No, there's absolutely no argument to be made for that. And the reason is because we do not need to sacrifice our environment and public safety in order to create some fleeting construction jobs. Those jobs can be done at places like the wind facility upstream at Paulsboro Terminal, where they're beginning to manufacture parts for wind. They can be done by unions at fair wages to develop the renewable resources and all the technology associated with that we need in order to turn away from fossil fuels, dirty fossil fuels, and move towards truly clean energy. And there are more jobs there. We know from studies that are coming out that the renewable energy sector is growing faster than the fossil fuel sector. In fact, the fossil fuel sector is dying. We should let it die its death, and we should move ahead instead with renewable sources and good, safer jobs, because the people who work at those terminals are also going to be exposed to this extreme safety hazard. And we know that a potentially explosive and highly flammable liquid like this LNG is very dangerous for the workers as well. So we want good, stable, clean jobs that will truly support people rather than throwing a few crumbs to a few of the workers in order to continue the development of this disastrous fuel project.
Tracy, you referenced the wind port, the New Jersey wind port, that's in Salem County, I believe. So Governor Murphy has said he wants to see more port space built along the Delaware River. Is the Riverkeeper Network okay with this, an increase in port space overall?
Well, we're actually looking closely at the site that they want to use in Salem County. I was talking about the existing Paulsboro Terminal.
Okay.
It's just about 3.5 miles upstream. It's one of the alternatives that they could have used if they wanted to have just a roll-on, roll-off type of terminal like New Fortress Energy pretended they were trying to build at Gibbstown. They hid that they were going for LNG till we found it out through a Freedom of Information Act request. But up there in Paulsboro, they're going to be manufacturing parts for wind turbines. And what we are saying is that those are the jobs of the future.
So are you okay then with more port space as we're perhaps, I think that the wind port in Salem County is also supposed to be involved in manufacture of windmill parts?
I can't say that we are opposed or in favor of any particular port until we go through our normal process at Delaware Riverkeeper Network at looking at the facts.
Got it.
And we are always concerned about new dredging and new projects, but we do know that there are existing ports looking for customers.
All right, Tracy Carluccio, we're going to have to leave it there, but we appreciate your joining us today for the Regional Roundup. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much, Mary.
Tracy Carluccio is Deputy Director of the Delaware Riverkeeper Network. Up next, jazz trombonist and composer Papo Vasquez talks about his music and his latest album, and should be fun. Stay tuned. Regional Roundup on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Papo Vasquez's newest album is called Chapter 10, Breaking Cover, a reference to the moment he was able to emerge from a pandemic lockdown in 2020 to safely gather and record with his group, the Mighty Pirates Troubadours. The clip we're hearing is Mr. Babu. Vasquez is a Grammy-nominated trombonist, composer, and arranger who was born in North Philadelphia, spending his youth in both Philly and Puerto Rico. His father was a troubadour of Puerto Rican heritage, his uncle a guitar player. Vasquez picked up the trombone in elementary school, and by the time he was 15, he was performing with local Latin bands. It's a passion which has spanned a 40-year career, numerous albums, and recognition as a leader in contemporary Latin jazz. So to round out the hour, we thought we'd take a break from some of the tougher news of the day to listen to some of his latest work and talk about his music. Papo Vasquez, what a pleasure.
Good morning, Mary. Can you hear me?
I can hear you just fine. How are you?
Great, great, great. Everything is marvelous. I'm extremely excited. I'm excited to be here with you, and I'm extremely grateful for the invitation.
Well, we're glad to have you with us. And why don't we begin by talking about the name of the band, Mighty Pirates Troubadours? It's such a great name. How did you come up with it?
Well, it wasn't actually my idea. It was something that was said to me in a jokingly manner from a friend of a co a friend of mine who was we were playing together. We were working together with the Ruben Blades band back in I think it was 1992, and I'm not exactly sure, but it was circa 1992 because I was still using the original name of my band. It was called Papo Vasquez Bomba Jazz, which I started back in Puerto Rico in 1984. But then one day I was at another friend's house, the great Mario Rivera, who's a great saxophone player. Me and him, we worked together with Tito Puente, and one of his he had some people that were visiting, and when he introduces me to them, he says, "Oh, this is Mr. Papo Vasquez," and they say, "Oh yeah, this is Mr. Bomba Jazz." So that's when I kind of like, you know, because bomba is the style of music that we play. Bomba jazz, that's the style of music that we play.
Mm-hmm.
And but I kind of didn't like that because I felt like it was pigeonholing me into a corner. So I wasn't happy with the name of that as a name for the band. So one day we were in, I think it was Chicago, we're traveling with Ruben, and the bass player Mike Vina says to me, because I mentioned that, you know, I was thinking about changing the name of the band. And he says to me, "Well, you know," jokingly around, he says, "Well, you don't know that what you are is a pirate troubadour." I said, "A pirate troubadour? I had never heard that. I didn't even know that existed," to be mentioned it to me. I said, "A pirate troubadour, wow." So I liked that so much that I adopted that as the name for my band.
It was just such a fun name. So we've got a selection from your new album, Breaking Cover. And again, this was recorded just as, you know, you were just beginning to able to regather with your bandmates, you know, kind of early on in the pandemic. This is called El Cuco. Let's take a listen. So, Papo, I understand the piano riff for this was composed before the pandemic, but it really speaks to what we're going through right now. You don't always see El Cuco or the boogeyman coming.
Well, that piano riff, see, what I do once in a while, I'll sit down at the piano and I'll just record stuff. You know, if I'm in the mood, and I have a digital recorder. So for these productions, what I usually do is before I even put, you know, nowadays, it's, I guess, fingers to the computer because we use these marvelous software that we use to compose music nowadays. But I do that. I do a lot of research, you know. So we were about to record the record at the end of March. We already have been rehearsing. We had done two rehearsals, in March. By the middle of March, we started hearing that they were going to close everything down at the end of March. So when that happened, everything had to stop. So we had to wait to the end of June, when the governors of New Jersey and New York, they allowed people, the gatherings of 20 people. That's when we decided to get back together. And of course, I'm extremely grateful for all the gentlemen in this production. That was so brave. It was very strange, but then again, it's not strange because the way we record our records, we go to a certain recording studio which is called Kaleidoscope, we're all isolated anyway, you know, because I get a better sound like that.
That's interesting. Everybody.
Yes, you know, that's the way we record my records because there's so many different parts to it. We've done records before. Everybody's in the same room, and it gets real complicated when you go to what we call a mix. When you try to mix all the instruments, everything is leaking into everybody else. It could be a nightmare. So we all figured that we're all going to be isolated anyway. So it worked fine.
In a strange way, it kind of worked out. So, Papo Vasquez, tell us about your early years in North Philly and the draw of the local Latin clubs that were there at the time. Who was playing and what was it about the... Go ahead,
Larry,
I'm sorry.
By the way, I didn't mean to interrupt you, but we were all wearing masks and gloves and stuff. So,
oh,
yes, it was kind of strange.
Well, good to know. So in the 1960s and 70s, when you were a youth and you were, I think, as I understand it, you spent time, you know, growing up in both North Philly and Puerto Rico. What was the draw of the local Latin clubs, and who were some of the names that you remember playing, and, you know, why did that grab you?
Well, you know, I come from a musical family. You know, my father and my uncles, and you know, from my father's side of the family, there's a large family. So I had uncles that were young, close to my age, and the older they got, the more, you know. But you know, my older uncles and my grandfather, they played troubadour music. So I was always exposed to, you know, live music in the living room. You know.
Well, what's troubadour music?
Well, it's typical music from Puerto Rico, the mountain music from Puerto Rico. Yes, it's played with a cuatro, an instrument called the huicharo, which is like a güiro, they have different styles and concepts, but one of them is a controversy. So you have one guy singing something, and the other. It's very interesting. It's very interesting, and it's what I consider the Puerto Rican blues.
So, and your father apparently was a pretty good softball pitcher, and this is in Philly now, and he would, as you told our producer John Ahrens, would close his store and play at Fairmount Park. And one of the songs from your new album is called Fairmount Park, so we're going to play that clip right now. Fairmount Park from Papa Vasquez's new album, along with the Mighty Pirate Troubadours, Mighty Pirates, rather, Troubadours album. That's Chapter 10, Breaking Cover. And so Papa, what in this song evokes Fairmount Park for you?
Well, those Sundays that we spent at Fairmount Park with my dad, you know. And it had been a while that I've been wanting to compose something to dedicate to Philly. And one day I was in my car, and a Will Smith tune came on, and it had that kind of, that tempo kind of groovy thing, or that groove that we're using in this composition. I said, one day I'm going to write something like that. So for this record, I sat down and I attempted, and I was able to reach my goal. Because sometimes I would sit down, and I remember the day years back, I would try to compose something and give it a name at the beginning, and then instead of being Mary's Blues, I would write Adelina's Mambo. but for this one, I was able to reach my goal, which was to compose something with that like a you know, Sunday nice, you know, groovy kind of thing, you know, relaxed, you know. And I think we reached our goal with that composition there.
So when you were a fairly young man, when you became a leading musician you ended up in New York City and you made it in New York's Latin jazz scene of the late 70s. Were there different differences in the approach to Latin jazz and the scene itself when comparing Philly with New York?
Well, you know, you got to understand that when I began my career as a young musician in Philadelphia, playing with the local bands, we were the bands that were alternating with the major, you know, groups that were coming out of New York. So New York, you know, during the 70s and the 60s was the mecca, you know, of the Latin, you know, dance music back then. That's how I was able to go to New York, because I met musicians when we were alternating with them in Philadelphia.
I guess my question is there a difference in the way the Philly Latin jazz sound, you know, is there a difference between that sound and the Latin jazz sound out of New York City?
Well, me personally, one of my goals has always been one of the goals of my experimental music was to forward our folkloric music with a modern spin to it. So what was known back then throughout the world, you know, and not just Philly or New York, was, you know, Afro-Cuban music. And me being a Puerto Rican, when I was living in Puerto Rico during the early 80s, when I was a part of a band called Batacumbele, which became another cult band, I wanted to go in a different direction. And what I wanted to do was experiment with our Puerto Rican folklore and create new variations of that. Now, if there's a difference between... I don't know how big the Latin jazz scene in Philadelphia is, but mostly we were always like what I know about when I grew up is the most popular music that was being played was dance music with a dance bands.
Okay.
Dance bands back in the 70s in Philly. So, and not even in New York City back in the 70s the only guys that were playing that kind of the style of music were Mongo Santa Maria and maybe Willie Bobo, but there weren't that many Latin jazz bands back then in the 70s the 70s when I moved to New York.
Okay.
By the way, I actually became part of a movement that of a whole new generation of Latin jazz players. There was like Jerry Gonzalez Ford Apache Band, Hilton Ruiz, David Valentin. You know, a long list of that was a new generation back in the mid 70s.
So
right, because the most popular music was dance music. Remember that? That's that was the most prevalent thing that was happening in New York and in Philadelphia.
Okay, so I'd like to get to just briefly bomba, which is it's the music of Puerto Rico. Am I right?
That's one of the folkloric music from Puerto Rico, yes.
And it has, as I understand, African roots. And Tomas Peña writes of you in Jazz de la Peña, of you. He writes, his deep knowledge of the indigenous music of the Caribbean peoples intertwined with his decades-long dedication to jazz affords him to be an expert in fusing these two idioms. You know, as we kind of wrap up the show here, was it a stretch to marry jazz with the indigenous music of the Caribbean or the Caribbean?
Well, what you're listening to now on this recording is actually, you know, the beginnings of me as a leader was 1984. So it's taking me, 84, 94, almost 35 years to evolve this thing, because it was a process of, you know, trial and error. You know, you see what works, what doesn't work. And what you're listening to on this record is the result of many years of trial and error and making things work together, you know, gel nicely. Follow?
So you feel the marriage of the jazz and the indigenous music of Puerto Rico is a good one.
Well,
sounds good.
It's American. You know, this is an American art form.
Papa,
Puerto Rico.
You know what? We're going to have to leave it there. And we're going to end on a you know song from Chapter 10, Breaking Cover, called Fiesta de la Sanse, which is just kind of a nice celebratory song. Papo, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Mary. Have a marvelous day.
You too. Our engineer today has been Diana Martinez. Our producer, John Ahrens. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Great to have you with us. Be well.